A web meeting. Mr. Gary sir, அவர்கள் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று புக் டூ பார்ட் ஒன், ஃபர்ஸ்ட் சாப்டர், இன்டிட்டர்மினேட், காஸ்மிக் டிட்டர்மினேஷன் அண்ட் இன்டிட்டர்மினபிள், இந்த தலைப்பில் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். அன்பர்கள் அனைவரும் பங்கெடுக்குமாறு தாழ்மையுடன் வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறோம்.
Good morning. I think it's a very bold, brave group that comes to spend the whole morning talking about a chapter entitled Indeterminate, Cosmic Determinate, and the Indeterminable, because it would be natural for us to ask, what does all this have to do with us? In fact, the title of the chapter, the title of the chapter seems to suggest a lot of more questions than answers, which is true. In this chapter, Sri Aurobindo asks all the questions that we can ever ask, or anyone can ever ask, the scientist can ever ask about the nature of reality. And then he gives the answers which nobody has ever given before. We're doing some research at MSF on science and the development of science, and I'm reading an interesting book by Dr. Robert Lanza. I'm saying it's interesting because it's a very interesting story about himself. When he was about 9 or 10, he was growing up in Boston, Massachusetts, in a very poor, broken kind of family. None of the parents or children ever went to higher education. His older sister, who was his favorite, she was expelled from the high school, I think, and the principal of the high school called his mother and said that nobody in your family will ever amount to anything. You're all useless people. Maybe he didn't word the word useless, but that's what he meant. Well, this young 10-year-old boy wanted to prove the principal wrong. They announced a science contest at the high school, at the school, and he came up with the idea of trying to convert white chickens into black chickens by genetic breeding. And he went to his high school science teacher and asked him, and he says, it's impossible, you're wasting your time. So the boy was living near Harvard University. So one day he went to Harvard and he went to the biology building, and he tried to enter so he could consult the professor there. And the guard at the gate stopped him right there and said, I'm sorry, you can't enter here. Please go away. The boy lingered around for a while, and pretty disappointed, he walked around to the back of the building. And there he saw a fairly old man, a black man, dressed in very rough clothes with blue jeans, carrying some garbage out and putting it in a bin. So he went up to to this man who he understood was the janitor for the building. And when the man went back inside, he didn't say anything. When the man went back inside, he went in with him. And the man said, are you looking for something? He thought if he could impress the man that he might get somewhere. So he said, actually, I am conducting experiments on genetic engineering and inbreeding and crossbreeding using new DNA techniques. He was making up half of this just for some words he had heard. I wanted to consult an expert here who could guide me. Then he thought he should make friends with the man. So the man asked, is your father a doctor or a scientist? So he thought he should make friends with the man and tell him, I'm like you. I'm a poor man like you. He said, my father's, we're poor people. My father's a professional gambler. The so-called janitor led him down the hall and took him into a laboratory and went up to a scientist who was sitting at the counter and whispered something into his ear. And the scientist turned and greeted the boy, and he spent the rest of the day there at the lab learning what they're doing and getting advice on his experiments. And he went on to win the science contest at the school, and the principal, who had insulted his mother, was forced to give the prize, the school prize, to the son. But the story didn't stop there. It turns out the so-called janitor was the chairman of the Department of Neurobiology at Harvard and Nobel laureate. And he took interest in the boy. The boy got his high school education. He went on to Harvard. He got his college education. He became a scientist. And he's been working for the last maybe 50 years now with that Nobel laureate and the other scientist who was there in the lab. And he's become fairly world famous himself. So the question is, what happened? Or rather, why did this happen? How did this happen? Think about the most important event in your life. The most important life-determining or life-changing event in your life. What made them happen? How far do we really know? Can we really say with any clarity as to how I got to where I am right this minute? And often it's not just the big thing. It's not just the life. Where things don't happen before our very eyes that are really inexplicable. Oh, in the tradition, we say it must be my karma, or it's my heart. This day is not auspicious for me, this hour is not auspicious. If it's something good and we're devotees of Mother, we say, Mother's grace. But how far do we really understand? This is the subject of the first chapter of Book 2. The title, Indeterminate, Cosmic Determinants, and the Indeterminable. I can never remember the title of the chapter because each of the words itself is indefinable. What is an indeterminate? What is an indeterminate? Well, we know what a determination is. I'm determined to complete this work. I have a will and a determination to complete this work. What's an indeterminate? Something that doesn't seem to be determined by anybody's will. It just happened. Then what's a cosmic determinant? Well, as he tells us in this chapter, and as the scientist knows very well, the whole world seems to be determined in a particular way. After all, we're now pretty clear that the Earth that's going around the sun, and not vice versa, which many people thought for hundreds and hundreds of years. Actually, Sri Aurobindo tells us that from a spiritual point of view, it's neither the Earth going around the sun or the sun going around the Earth. That's something else. But for as far as we know, the moon is going around the Earth is going around the sun, and the whole solar system, which is a tiny speck in the universe, is going around and rotating within a galaxy. Something must have determined this arrangement. We have a 24-hour day on Earth, not a 12-hour day or a 240-hour day. Though sometimes I wish it was a little longer than it is. What determined that? This is the subject of this chapter. And in this chapter, he's going to tell us there is a process by which everything is determined. And this is a long chapter. I'm hoping to get about halfway through. I won't say I'm determined, but that's my objective, to get about halfway through. And next month, we come to the real answer, which he calls the process of creation, by which everything is determined. Well, let's review for a minute. Book one, it's the omnipresent reality in the universe. And he has concluded book one. We also have concluded book one, at least for our first effort, by saying his conclusion is that a consciousness force, an infinite consciousness force, inherent in existence, not something that came from somewhere else, not something unconnected with the fundamental reality of Brahman, but an infinite force inherent in the very nature of reality, which is Brahman, is acting everywhere, concealed. And that force is the creator of the universe. And that force is the creator of everything in the universe. Well, now that we know what has determined everything, we can probably skip this 33 pages and relax, except for that basic idea, what do we really understand? Because when we look at the world, we don't see an infinite creative force and consciousness. In fact, we rarely see much of reason or sense in all the things that are going on around us. And unless we want to say that that infinite creative force is unsensible, kind of like Lydia, we really haven't explained much yet. He says this infinite conscious force is occult in nature. It's there in all of nature. It's there in everything that happens. It's there in every event. But it's not on the surface. Surface to a very large to us. But it has a purpose. And Sri Aurobindo has a purpose in writing this chapter. His purpose is to help reveal to us the process by which that infinite consciousness force is acting in nature, how it is acting, why it is acting the way it is, and what it is expressing and what it is trying to accomplish. Part of our problem, maybe all of our problem, comes down to the fact that this infinite consciousness force has two aspects or two ways of acting. Two ways that are known in the tradition as the knowledge and the ignorance. It can act directly to affect what it wants to achieve through knowledge. It can act from behind, concealed, indirectly, through the ignorance. That's particularly relevant to us because we happen to be in the second category here, where we are in the ignorance, all our actions are in the ignorance, and all that we surround us, with very few exceptions, seems to be good examples of the ignorance. And so the challenge for us is, how do we discover what is really the determinant in this ignorance? What its purpose? What its direction? And what we should do to come out of it? He says that the basis for the world we live in is an apparent. Always be careful when Sri Aurobindo uses the word apparent, because he really means it isn't, but it only looks that way. The world is an apparent inconscient. We're surrounded by apparently inconscient matter, apparently a world that's not aware of us and doesn't think much or care much about us, a body that doesn't listen to us and do the things we would like it to do, and maybe our children are like that too. But the truth is something else is going on there. Consciousness is emerging out of that inconsciousness. Consciousness, which is concealed in nature, in material world, in the natural world, in the human world, is gradually, slowly coming out infinitesimally, drop by drop by drop. And hopefully that's true in us all. But Appa would like it to come out not in drops, but in buckets. So that we can speed up the process and don't be from the ignorance of knowledge. We had an interesting discussion on one of our P&P calls recently, asking, why in the world did Bingley call Dorothy stupid? And that was a really stupid thing to do. It's true that Darcy was behaving in a very stupid way, standing there, coming to a dance, and then looking very proud and self-important and offending everybody simply by his look. But I doubt very much whether anybody in the world had ever dared to call Darcy stupid before. And Bingley's not anybody. He's somebody who's looking up to Darcy, depending on him. It's Darcy that's taking him up in society. Darcy's his patron. Darcy's like his older brother. Why in the world did he call Darcy stupid right in the middle of a dance where maybe somebody could hear it? I mean, the results of it for him were pretty clear. He had to wait 1 year to get his marriage after that because Darcy was consciously or subconsciously so annoyed, he just canceled the engagement with Jane. What made him do it? And why, when Darcy responded and looked at her, the girl who was the future, the goddess for him, the thing he most wanted in life, why the first word out of his mouth was intolerable? And worse than that, he said it loud enough so she could hear it. I mean, not a very good start to any relationship, I suppose. Why did it happen? So our concern in this chapter is not just why the earth is going around the sun, but our concern is why every act happens, why other people act the way they do, why we act the way we do. Arini tells me there's a question from Ashok, and I welcome it. I'd like, because we have a good deal of time. What's on your mind? Now we are at the beginning of book two. And book two consists of two parts, part one and part two. Part one is the infinite consciousness, the ignorant. In book one, he has told us how the omnipresent reality, how Brahman has become the relationship between Brahman and the universe. Now he's
Mary, can you hear me now?
Yes, now we hear you. Very loud, very clear.
You see, the question I want to ask is, the Supreme is supposed to be bound by nothing and governed by nothing, and he is, in a way, indeterminable. But at the same time, he subjects his creation to the most rigorous rules and regulations governing his creation. How do you reconcile his infinite freedom he enjoys at his level with the terrible fixity that governs his creation? I feel the situation is somewhat comparable to a king and his subject. I feel it is unfair for the king to give himself total freedom, yet subject his citizens to the tremendous rules and regulations. How do you reconcile this anomaly of infinite freedom for the Supreme and at the same time terrible fixity for the subjects?
It's a very good question, Ashok, because the last term of this chapter, which I forgot to get to, was the indeterminable. That's the third term. And this chapter and the next chapter, especially even more, is really about the nature of the indeterminable. What is the indeterminable, which we refer to as the Supreme? In the tradition, there's an old line in the tradition which assumes that the Supreme is capable of determinating. Because it's called indeterminable, or it's indefinable, or it's inexpressible, there's been the assumption that maybe the Supreme is incapable of becoming anything. But Sri Aurobindo clearly explains to us that the Supreme can become and does become everything. And if we say that, well, because the Supreme is infinite and free, it can do anything it wants as long as it remains free, then it's not free to find itself. It's not free to limit itself. Well, if you follow the logic of that argument, you find if the Supreme were not free to limit itself, there would be no universe. Because the only way that the infinite can create a universe is by limiting itself. Because universe is finite, the Supreme is infinite, and there is no such thing as an infinite form. There is no such thing as an infinite thing. And we live in a universe of forms and things and beings. So Sri Aurobindo explains that the very inherent power of the infinite, of Brahman, is it can become anything. It can become finite beings. It can. So that's a real problem for it, because there's nobody else. So if it wants to conceal it, it has to conceal itself from itself. And it has the power to do that as well. It has the power for the sheer joy of adventure, of forms, involving itself in forms so that it forgets itself and can have the joy of evolving out and reawakening to what it is. Now, our language is somewhat inadequate here, because being the infinite, no matter how many times or in how many forms the divine chooses to forget itself, it still knows itself, and it still is itself, and it's still infinite and free and unbound at the same time. So I think the answer to your question, the real answer to your question is that our problem is that we think of the divine as somebody else than us. It's a natural confusion we have, because all along that's the way we've been taught and thought of things. But there's only the divine. And if the divine decides to forget itself, it means that one part of itself or one aspect of itself hides from itself, while another aspect of itself remains infinitely free, unbound, and omniscient. And what we call spiritual evolution, I don't know about you, but when I think about spiritual evolution, I think of how I, my individual soul, as if I have an individuality separate from everything, is going to come out of the ignorance. But what Sri Aurobindo means of spiritual evolution is the spirit is evolving, not just you and me. The spirit is evolving. And when the spirit's evolving, it's the spirit that's involved in the universe. It's the cosmic spirit that's evolving. It's all the individual souls who are lost in the ignorance that's evolving. And it's the transcendent being that's evolving. Not three things, because there's not three things, there's only one. It's three aspects of the infinite divine that is evolving a universe. The divine doesn't need evolution, it's up above, but in manifestation it has chosen to create a universe that's progressively evolving. And how does it evolve? Well, one part of it is sitting up there, looking down and sending down hints to us as to how we can wake up. The other part is buried down below and is trying to wake up and realize that we're not just separate people imprisoned in our small cabins here, but we're really something greater. And the world around us is not different than us. It's also part of ourselves. And he's managed to create this very interesting story, more interesting even than Pride and Prejudice, with many more characters and complexities and plots and subplots to it, in which the three of these are interacting for the evolution. So I think that's a long answer to your question. I think the short answer to your question is, it's not the divine that is bound here. It's we are having the joy of playing hide and seek from ourselves. Sri Aurobindo politely calls it the taste of ignorance. We're enjoying the involution, the ignorance. Just like a small child who loves to play hide and seek with the parents and pretend to be not found. And so to have the joy and the surprise of when we are found out, when they're found out. Now you have to tell me whether that was satisfactory or not.
Except that there is only the divine and there is nothing else, this can lead to logical absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand? You see, if there is only the divine, then how do you understand the atheist, which would mean that the God in the form of atheist is denying himself? This doesn't sound logically even sensible.
Exactly. Now you're getting really to the joy of his creation. And Sri Aurobindo goes even further. He says, very often, I think you know this, very often the atheist is more sincere than the devotee. Because the atheist really doesn't know who he is and really doesn't believe, and he's searching for answers. And Sri Aurobindo has written in Life Divine explaining the great service that atheism has done. Because by having the courage to question, sincerely question, not perversely question, so much of superstition can really understand more. I was there'll be no market for it at all, because everybody already believed so much of superstition, there was no question left. 500 years of atheism have really made people begin to question what's the truth. And this book I mentioned in the beginning, this author, he's a scientist who's challenging all the fundamentals of modern science, from quantum theory and relativity to Darwinian evolution, not as a theist, not as a mystic, but even scientifically, he said it doesn't make sense. I think he's doing a great service to the world by asking us to go for a greater knowledge and not just accept a superstitious belief. And instead of saying he's doing the greatest service, I would say Divine has created the atheist also so that he can, the world can make a greater progress.
Okay, okay.
Thanks for the good question. So in book two, he first of all is going to explain to us in 14 chapters how the infinite consciousness has become the ignorance, what the ignorance really is. He's told us in book one what the knowledge is or what the truth is, what the reality is. But we live somewhere else most of the time. What is our world? What's the truth of this world? How is it created? What is this ignorance? What are we? What is the ego? How are we trapped? If we're really the infinite one, how do we wake up every morning feeling somewhat different than that? And he starts this chapter not from his point of view, but from the point of view of the ordinary human being who for hundreds and hundreds of years has been asking basic questions about the nature of reality and the world around him, which have been asked by science particularly, and which we ask when we read Pride and Prejudice. What is it that brought Darcy and Bingley to America? Why of all places did they come to America? And why did Bingley run away to London 3 weeks after he came when he met a girl that he really liked? Oh, we have some explanation for why Dusty wanted him to go or Carolyn wanted him to go, but why did he go? What did he think? What brought Wickham to the place on earth probably liked to avoid? If Darcy was there, he would have never come to Meryton. The whole reason he had to unleash a scandal was to try to defend himself, because he was sure that Darcy would expose him to everybody, which Darcy didn't do. And one for Collins. At the very same time, within 3 weeks, four of them come. And three of them marry into the family within 1 year. What brought them? What brought them here? What brought them now? On the day that Lizzie and her sisters are walking into Meryton with Collins, they are introduced to Wickham. And just at that moment, when they're meeting Wickham for the first time, Darcy and Bingley drive by. Why? What brought them together at that very moment? And that was enabled Lizzie to see the animosity that Darcy had for Wickham. In 1 second, she got a whole story. And then that evening, Wickham told her a real story to justify his position, which unleashed the scandal, which unleashed her abuse of Darcy at Hunsford. And when she so emphatically told him, "You're the last man on earth I would ever marry." Why did it happen? Why did any of these things happen? How did Charlotte end up marrying Colin? I mean, we know what happened, the physical action, but why? Why Charlotte? Why not Mary? Why not Kitty? What took Lizzie to Rosings at the time when Darcy's coming there? She didn't want to go. Charlotte asked her to come. What brought Darcy at this time? What made the gardeners cancel it to the Lake Country and go to Derbyshire instead? And what made Darcy come back 1 day early so that 10 minutes after they've emerged from the house, he's walking up the path and they meet? What brought the elopement just at the moment? Lizzie's sitting there in the inn reading the letter from Jane, and Darcy walks in the door. And she's in the middle of her tears. She's completely uncontrollable, and she comes in and she spills the whole secret to him. If he had come an hour earlier, it would have, maybe he would have proposed to her. That's one of my theories. And if he proposed to her 1 hour before the elopement, what would he have felt like 1 hour later when he said, "My God, what have I done? I've really got myself into..." If he had come an hour later, they would have already been gone. What made... This is one of the most intriguing questions we've been discussing. What made Darcy, I don't mean what he thought at the time, we know, but Darcy has prevented Bingley from marrying Jane by saying, "You can afford to marry into such a low family. Maybe a nice girl, you cannot afford to do it." Look at the situation he got himself into. 1 year later, he desperately wants to marry Elizabeth. Now the main obstacle for him, he has two obstacles. One is Lizzie has said he's the last man, and he's trying to move heaven and earth to change her view of him. But even if he can change her view, he still has to deal with Bingley. Because unless Bingley agrees to marry Jane, he's got no chance. Now, many things could have happened during that 1 year. I mean, Bingley's a very impulsive guy. He could have married four other girls during that year because he falls in love with a girl every week or two when he sees a new girl. That's what they say. Supposing he had married somebody, what would be Darcy's position? Jane is still unmarried. He can never go back and face her and propose to her again. Or let's be more imaginative. Supposing Darcy's gone to Bingley and said, "Bingley, I thought about it and I think I was wrong to interfere. And if you want to marry Jane, I think it's okay." Not having the courage to tell him that you have to marry her, otherwise her sister won't marry me. And Bingley says, "No, Darcy, I'm grateful to you. I've thought about it a lot. You know I'm a very impulsive man. You're a wise man. You have advised me not to marry into that family. And so I've decided to follow your advice. And I'm resolved to it." Now what's his position? He has to beg Bingley to marry the girl. And he has to confess to Bingley that if you don't marry her, her sister won't marry me. And what's their position then? But all that didn't happen. Why? What's the determinant? Well, we commonly give lots of answers or no answers. Yes, life is like that. It's confusing. He was lucky or unlucky. Why all the luck goes to other people and not to me, I don't know. That's karma. This is karma. That's what you deserve. That's nature. Jane Austen started off the story, the very first line she says, it's a law. It's a natural, it's a known truth. Truth. What is a truth? A truth is a law, a necessity, a nature. It's a law. It's a known truth that a rich man who's not married must be in virtue of a wife. So Jane Austen herself believes in some kind of natural laws of necessity that are working out. What's the role of choice, free will in all of this? How much of this do we really have a choice? If it's all a question of chance, then where does choice come in? If it's all a question of law and nature and compulsion and necessity, and then how does grace come into this whole thing, God's will? All of it's quite indeterminable. What are the determinants in our lives? When I was 15, I grew up in New York, a suburb of New York called White Plains. It was a nice place. At the age of 15, my family moved out to Southern California, to Los Angeles. 3 months later, I was enrolled in a high school in Los Angeles. I remember in the city itself, there were 40 high schools. And on the first or second day at school, I was looking around. Naturally, everybody knew everything. So I was looking around, and I saw somebody that just surprised me because he looked almost identical to a boy who was my classmate 2,500 miles away, 3 months earlier. And I guess I was a little obvious about it because I kept looking at him each time I got a chance because he looked so familiar. I said, of course, it couldn't be the same person, but can there really be two people who look so much alike? And finally, the boy came up to me and said, hi, Gary, how are you? You mean to say that two of us from the same school, I don't know, maybe we had 300 students in our class, 2,500 miles away, moved across to the other end of the country. Even in the same city, he could have gone to one of 40 schools, and there were 100 schools in the whole county, and that we chose the same school and ended up going there together. What makes it happen? And conference went very well. I went down into the lobby. We were preparing to go to dinner. And I saw a man come into the lobby who in the organization, the international organization, the academy that I work with, he was one of our members of the academy, one of two members who resigned from the academy, the only man in the whole academy who had a false, unpleasant rumor about the service society. Maybe the one man in the academy or one that I would never like to meet again. And there he was in the lobby, and I looked at him. He looked at me. I knew who he was. He recognized me as somebody he knows, but he couldn't figure out who I was. So he came up and he says, I think we know each other. And as soon as I said my name, he understood who it was. I'm sure he was equally sorry to meet me. I always disliked this man. I don't dislike many people, but this man used to irritate me because he was so arrogant, even before he insulted us or spread rumors about us. I've not seen such arrogant, self-satisfied person before. Why? I am 4,000 miles away from where I live. He's at least 1,000 miles away. He didn't come for my event. Even in Bucharest, there's 100 hotels. Even if he's staying in the hotel, I might be there for a week and not know it. But when I go down into the lobby, there's only one man there, and it's him. Why? What is the determinant? I was totally puzzled. And then last week, I was sitting in meditation and thinking about some things, and maybe I was thinking about the talk, I'm not sure. But I was thinking, why did that man come there? I mean, how do I explain it? What happened? There must be a reason for that. Then I remembered, suddenly it occurred to me, that during the second day of the meeting, that is just 2 or 3 hours before, the meeting was floundering and people were just not knowing where to go. And I gave an idea, a suggestion of how, what Appa would have said to do in a circumstance like this. And they liked the suggestion and they followed and the meeting became a great success. And I don't even think anybody paid attention to the fact that I had given the idea, but I noted that I had given an idea and made the meeting a success. I don't think I was very proud about it, but yes, that sense of self-satisfaction. I had another experience, that reminds me of another experience of mine that happened 22 years ago, which I may have shared in an earlier meeting long time ago. We gave proposals to create full employment in India. We wrote a report. Appa gave the inspiration. I was doing the work with Dr. Rangasamy, who worked with us. We never thought anything would come of it, but it was taken to the Prime Minister. The PM met us, appreciated the idea, loved the idea, and said, we're going to implement this. It was something unbelievable. And he called a meeting, and then he called a second meeting with the Planning Commission, and then he called a third meeting. And in the third meeting, he turned to the head of the Planning Commission, Pranab Mukherjee, who's now our president, and he said, we must do this. You must do this. And at that moment, some still small voice came up, not from the most enlightened part of my personality, but from the vital thing, just this irresistible sense of satisfaction. The next minute, there was a phone call for the PM. It was from Jayalalitha. She was calling to say that there was some violence on the border with Karnataka, and she needed assistance on that. And the PM left, and he never came back to another meeting of this project. And though the project lingered on for a couple of years, it never went beyond that stage. So I saw how my attitude of satisfaction could be the determinant. So these things are happening all the time, not just in big things, in small things, in microscopically tiny things. And in this chapter, he's trying to give us the whole vision and secret of that process. From an ordinary point of view, the world appears to be a paradox. It's got an origin which nobody can explain. And if you're thinking about theories of the Big Bang, or any of your kids are thinking about them, and you think that the Big Bang explains anything, and what did the Big Bang come from? And if you say it came from nothing, well, then you're pretty close to Vedanta, because you say everything has come out of nothing. And then you have to say, well, what determined that? Why did it decide to come out of nothing, and who determined it? And it's like the scientist who said, nobody determined it, it just happened. Why did it happen then? Why did it happen here, if there is such a thing as a here or a there? And if it really happened, why did everything that happened afterwards happen? Because even if you have, it doesn't explain why the universe is the way it is today. To the ordinary view, meaning to the ordinary mental view, the origin of the universe, our universe, the universe, everything, is a super-rational mystery. It's a paradox. The more we read about it, the more we can talk about the theory, the less we really know, less we really explain. Only thing is, we have things to talk about. We have names for it now. Well, it's a big bang. But everything really seems to come out of a big nothingness or a small nothingness. And the thing about this is that this nothingness has no characteristics at all. Even the scientists said, big bang, everything has come out of it, but what was it? Oh, we can't say. We can't say anything about it. You must be able to say something about it. Was it very big or very small? We don't know. Was it filled with things or was it empty? We don't know. How long was it there? Well, you really can't talk about it being there. So you mean it was there forever? Well, actually, time only began with the Big Bang. Time began. If time had a beginning, there must have been something before that beginning. How long will it go on? Will it go on forever, or will it also disappear into nothingness? And if it disappears into nothingness, doesn't the nothingness go on even if the universe doesn't? So isn't it eternal? These are fundamental questions which scientists addresses by ignoring them, by saying they're not questions that science can answer. So the origin of things seems to have no characteristics at all. Positively or negatively, sounds very suspiciously close to Brahman. It's an indeterminable. And out of that indeterminable came what? All of us. Everything. Came an infinite variety of things and beings and events that seems to go on forever in all directions, in space and time. Where did these things come from? Why are they the way they are? Well, we have an answer for that. We say nature created everything. And scientists is very scientific. He says nature is only a word. We are scientific. It's energy that has created all of these things. It's energy that came out of an explosion of nothingness started to organize itself as an orderly universe. Have you ever exploded something and seen it organize itself? I mean, an explosion seems to be the very opposite of order. If I take a glass bottle and throw it on the floor, you don't expect it to arrange itself in a nice, neat pattern. Quite the contrary, the nice, neat bottle becomes a complete disorder. But what does this energy do after exploding? It starts organizing itself. It says, well, let's build up some building blocks. We'll have a hydrogen and a helium and a carbon and an oxygen and a nitrogen. And let's keep building, and we'll do it very systematically. We'll add one electron and one proton here and one there and there. And we'll just go on and see what we can do. And you get an orderly assortment of elements which the scientists call the periodic table. And then it says, well, let's not stop there. Let's see what happens if you start joining these things together. And it starts creating molecules. And it creates so many different types of molecules. According to the scientists, we have 1 million types of protein in our body. a million different types of proteins in our body. Just the protein, let alone all of the carbohydrates and fats and everything else. How did they get created? I thought we started with an explosion which is going to break everything into pieces, and now we seem to have something orderly. And it gets more puzzling than that. Because we start with these tiny little sparks of energy, electrons, protons, or quarks, or whatever you want to call them, and they keep building into bigger things. Molecules decide, this is getting boring, let's do something, let's do you ever see something come alive out of it? Of course, you put live things into it when you put the curd and all. But the very nature of the cell is, it's not like a bunch of molecules at all. It's a bunch of molecules organized in a very systematic, comprehensive way with something on the inside and something on the outside and all working together in order to contain itself, feed itself, to reproduce itself. It's a lot of molecules with a mind of their own. How does it happen? I think we can cook all day long in the kitchen and never hope to create a plant, a living thing out of it. And these living things start multiplying by the million, first one cell, two cells, 10 cells, a million cells, and then they decide to create complex organisms that have organs in lungs, liver, brain, stomach, intestines, hands, that work to create something that you don't see in any cell. You see an organism with organs composed of billions and billions of cells. Well, I thought we started with explosion. Explosions break everything up into chaos. And yet, out of this chaos, we're getting an order. And the order seems to keep evolving, developing. It becomes more and more complex. And finally, after 14 billion years, we get an order in which the molecules and the cells are thinking and talking and marrying and working and earning, tiring, writing books, reading the book. Now we've got an explosion that's thinking about itself and why it happened and who created it and where it came from. How does it happen? Where did this come from? Where did this order come from? Who determined? Why do things have the qualities that they have? Why is gold shiny and lead dull? Why does water expand when it freezes? Most liquids don't. Why, when you take hydrogen and oxygen, which are two invisible gases, you put them together, you get a liquid, a clear, perfectly clear liquid. If you burn hydrogen, it's a fuel. If you try to burn water, the fire goes out. Water has characteristics totally different than the hydrogen and oxygen from which it consists. How did Mr. and Mrs. Bennett ever create five daughters who are so different from one another? Can Lydia and Lizzie and Jane really be members of the same family? By what process? It's totally baffling. So what's the answer to all of these questions? Well, science has thought of many different answers. One of their hypotheses is well, before I go to that, let me mention a few more things. Sri Aurobindo talks a lot about the seed and the tree. It's one of the great mysteries. It's like we all grew up with the chicken and the egg. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's the same. It's even more complex because there's one egg and one chicken. But with the seed, there's one seed and there's a tree which can create thousands of seeds. It's very baffling. And biologically, it's more that baffling. The seed is essentially one cell, one single type of cell that starts multiplying itself. And what does it do? It creates a shape, which is certainly not there in the seed. And it starts creating stem cells and root cells and leaf cells and fruit cells and flower cells and maybe nut cells. I don't know if they're nut cells, but or is it cell, whatever it is. How does it do that? Where does it get that information? Where does it get that inspiration? Where does it get that direction? Who's converting this single simple seed into this complex? Well, now we're back to the same question we started with. We started with a big bang, and out of that we're getting infinite complexity. Where is it coming from? Who's determining it? What is determining it? If it's not a who, it must be a what. There's order here. We can't deny the order. But there's also seems to be things that are constantly varying. And how, among all these things, do we explain, most of all, how molecules, atoms, and cells can become conscious? Because we start with a big bang saying there was nobody there, nothing there, nobody pulled the stitch, nobody was trying to create anything, and there was nobody, there was simply an explosion of energy. And now we've got energy that's walking and talking and graduating from college and getting married and doing so many things. Where did consciousness come from? If you say, as many scientists still at least try to maintain, that, well, consciousness is only a question of energy and chemistry going on in the body, then, of course, it means that the scientist is only a chemical reaction. And his science is only an electrical impulse in the brain. And his act of knowing is not really anybody knowing anything. It's only some chemicals moving around. So we don't really have to worry about consciousness because it doesn't exist. It's simply some chemistry. It's a lab experiment. I don't know about you, but that's not quite satisfying to me to think that that's all we are. And look at human life, look at society, because society we understand a little better than the Big Bang, as most of us. Society starts as many people, each with his own desires, impulses, energy, again, interacting, striving to survive, trying to eat and reproduce and defend themselves. And what does society do? Society is a mini universe of its own, even if it's confined to only one planet or one country. What does society do? It creates forms, just like the universe has done. We create forms like the family, the community, the village, the tribe, the caste, the class, the nation, the race. We create not only physical forms, we create social forms, marriage. Marriage is not a physical thing. You can't see, you can see a ceremony, but you can't see marriage. It's a social idea that we accept. Belief, religion, I belong to one, somebody belongs to another one. Beliefs, customs, behaviors. To a lot of people in this country, ragalam is a real thing. You can't see it. Karma is a real thing. But it's a belief. You can't measure it. We've got things like market and banks and farms and governments and armies and hotels and so many other things. We've got ideas of all description, philosophy. We've got relationships, affection, competition, jealousy, friendship, love, devotion. What are all of these things? Where did they come from? What are they made of? If we're really just a bunch of atoms or molecules or cells and electrical chemical impulses, how did we manage to create all of these things? Or how did somebody or something manage to create them all? Where did society come from? Where did the meditation center come from? Out of what? Our belief systems, our aspirations. What's driving this whole process? Well, I think the answers of science are far from capable of answering these questions. At best, what they can do is they can trace the external process by which we start a meditation center. Or a seed, if you put water in the right soil at the right time and get enough sunlight, how the seed sprouts. We can define it. They can sketch it. They can tell us how the DNA molecule splits and protein synthesis and so many things. But those are all what he calls the external how and why, not the real determining how and why. And we feel we've got knowledge and we're very satisfied. I mean, how did Darcy marry Elizabeth? Well, we know how. He went to a church and they got married. I mean, why did she marry him? How did, she said he's the last man on earth he would ever marry. How did the last man become the first man? By what circumstance? Then it becomes a little more difficult. So there's a mystery. There's more than one mystery. The whole thing is a mystery. And the more we look at it, the more closely we look at it, whether we look at it like the scientist or we look particles. Well enough, the Big Bang created infinitesimal electrical particles. Some of them are positive and some of them are negative. And the negative ones run after the positive ones. And they run away from their own negative, kind of like boy and girl. Why? Why are there positive and negative particles? Why do the negatives run after the positives or the positives after the negative? We don't know. Just the way things are. And it doesn't stop there. They join together and they create elements. What are the elements? Well, they're gases. Some of them are gases. Some of them are solids. Some of them are liquids. Some of them are metals. Some of them are salts. Why? End up as rocks of earth. As crystals. Why is mercury a liquid? Why do we have mercury at all? Why do we have so many types of gemstones? Precious, beautiful, rare. All these. Okay. You want the chemistry of it, then all the scientists will give you an explanation. But why? Why does this chemistry result in that result? We don't know. We still don't even know why water is what it is, let alone why a diamond or a ruby or a sapphire is what it is. And those that are studying these things, it's more baffling. Very baffling. When a crystal is created, crystal is created under certain conditions and a correct molecule will take a particular shape. And they've done a lot of experiments. Why does it take the particular shape it takes, which makes it sparkling and beautiful rather than cloudy and dull and ugly? And they assumed, well, that's the only shape it could take. And then they found out with many experiments, actually this crystal could probably have taken 100 or 1,000 different shapes. What's determining that it takes this shape? We don't know. No matter what you look at, if you go deep enough and don't just listen to the formulas and memorize the explanation, for it all we don't know. And then we've got life. Millions of tiny cells joining together to create living, functioning, breathing, reproducing, interacting organisms. Trees and ferns and mosses and algae and herbs and flowers and nuts. And then the whole animal kingdom, from the insects and the birds and the fishes and everything, up to the human level. And yet at the same time, we've got so many types. How many different types of flowers there are? We are, at least the devotees are aware. Mother named 800 flowers. 800 different types. Why are there 800 and not 8? Why are there 800 and not 8 million? And then if you really look, you see, each flower is unique. We may have a million of them, but each one, if you really study it, is unique. To those who don't relate to pets like dogs, cats, or horses or anything, oh, they all look the same. But no owner has difficulty recognizing their dog or cat or horse among 100 others, because they see the uniqueness and individuality. Well, if we've got all these types, how do we get so much of individuality? There are about 7 billion of us in the world today, and there'll be more pretty soon. And we're all pretty much the same. I mean, height means it's within a narrow range. We don't have any 10-foot boots. Two arms and two legs is pretty standard equipment. Two ears, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, preferably here and not somewhere else. We're all pretty much the same when you come to think of it. We live pretty much the same length of time. And there's variation. The oldest man in the world just died, I think, celebrated now in America as the oldest man. He's 112. Not much older than a lot of. He's not 240. So we're all pretty much the same. And yet, we each have a unique fingerprint. Unique fingerprint. 7 billion of us, different. What creates that difference? Why aren't all our fingerprints the same? And the human face is a remarkable thing, because in fact, despite of the fact that nobody's got a face this big and this long, and we're all pretty much the same size, 32 teeth, at least that was nature's gift to us, and all of these things, how many different twins with the same genetic to know them? Be so different. What creates that difference? These are the fundamental questions. What creates the type? What creates the differences? So science has come up with several explanations. And the first explanation is the creator of all of this chance. But it's not an ordinary chance. It's not your run-of-the-mill chance. It's a chance which has the capacity to self-organize it. Don't ask me how chance self-organizes itself. And don't ask the scientist either, though he's working on some pretty sophisticated explanations now of how chance can organize itself. I once imagined, if chance has really been the creator of all of this, then if we start traveling around to other galaxies and solar systems, and enough of us are traveling long enough, the chances are that we'll come to another planet where we'll come and land and we'll see there sitting on the soil an iPod or an iPad or a TV or a mixie that just happened to organize itself on the soil of this barren planet where there's no life, because chance is organizing. And it's kind of the theory that if you had a million monkeys typing long enough, that somebody would write a famous play like Shakespeare. That's self-organizing chance. So this is not really a very reassuring answer. It kind of raises more questions than it answers. But one of the assumptions is that maybe is an inconstant force. If nature's, that's Prakriti, if nature's an inconstant force acting at random without any determining principle, it's kind of like Lydia frolicking around, running from one boy to the other, one dance to another, but she's the first one to get married. It's a self-organizing sense. Is that what life is all about? Maybe, the theory says, maybe because it randomly works, some patterns seem to work better than others, and they keep repeating themselves, and they become habits, habits of nature, kind of like our preference for food. I think you must have noticed that whichever country a person's born in, whatever we eat when we're in the first 5 or 6 years becomes the preference of the body forever. If we were somewhere else, we'd be wondering how people could eat those things. They don't know the right thing to eat. The creatures have habits. So maybe it's chance acquired habits. But if this is, if all of life has been created by an energy, a self-organizing chance, where did it come from? Where did this energy come from? It must have come from something. There must have been something that existed that created that energy. And if this energy has created all of these things, then that existence must have had infinite potential to it, because it is created infinitely. So, regardless of what the energy is, we end up having to imagine that the origin of everything is an infinite existence with infinite possibility, which is pretty much a good definition of Brahman. But this Brahman has put forth an energy that doesn't think and doesn't intend anything, it just acts. The problem with this is that when we look at the universe, everything is very orderly. And there are a lot of rules. And how does chance make rules? One of the famous rules is, if you drop this, it falls. And it doesn't matter how many times you drop it and where on earth you drop it, it's going to fall every time. It's a rule. More than that, we say it's a universal law discovered by Newton called the law of gravity. And like that, there are hundreds of laws. Why? Why should things fall when you drop them and not go sideways or go up? We say, no, it has to go down. But who decided it has to go down? After all, what I call down is up for somebody else. I may think that down relative to them. So up is down. Where do these laws come from? Laws of magnetism, electricity, gases. If you heat a gas, it expands. Why doesn't it shrink? No, it's a law. Who made the law? We started with an indeterminate test. You mean the laws were there before the test? Before the Big Bang? No, there was nothing there before the Big Bang. Well, if the laws were there before the Big Bang, then there was something before the Big Bang. Then it's not chance, it's not the origin. There were laws that gave rise to chance. So which is it? There are scientists grappling now with a very interesting dilemma. Because it turns out, the more you study the universe, it turns out that more perfect this universe is designed for us. It's so perfectly designed that if some of the things were just a tiny bit different than they were, how tiny? There are some of these things that if they're 1 millionth different than they are, there would be no life in the universe. There are about 4,000 what the scientist calls constants, universal constants. We know one of them, the speed of light. When a hydrogen atom clings to another hydrogen atom to create a molecule of gas, it clings with a certain strength. It's called a bond. Why is it that way? Well, we say it's chance. But if that chance were just a millionth part, or let's say a hundredth part different than it is, this hydrogen bond would not be strong enough to create all of the molecules that we have in the world, there would be no life in the universe. So how do we start it out with a universe created by chance? But it turns out that 4,000 variables that are essential for this universe are exactly what they need to be. And if they were slightly different, we would not be here, whether there would be a universe or not. We would not be here to be asking the question of why. So when you start with chance, it looks like a far stretch to say chance just happened to get 4,000 numbers perfectly right, exactly to the millionth or thousandth decimal place. How did it do that? By chance? Well, the scientist is very reluctant to admit an alternative, so he's found a simple solution to this. A very simple solution that you and I would have thought of also if we had work for about 1 million years. He says, you see, actually there are millions of universes. And in this particular universe, chance got it all right. And in all the other millions of universes, it probably didn't get it right, and therefore we may be the only one who's around here to ask the question about how many universes there are. And if you think I'm joking, I wish I was. But the theory of multiple universes is being considered very seriously by very famous men. Some of them get Nobel Prizes for it, and some of them you know, like Stephen Hawking, who's world famous, the astrophysicist. So when you start working with untenable hypotheses, you can go away into the ignorant, thinking that you're being very wise. So not everybody agrees with this idea of chance. You say, no, the creator of the universe is not chance. It's necessity. It's mechanical necessity. The universe is simply a clock. It's a machine. And it works with clockwork precision. After all, the sun rises every day. It stays there just for a certain amount of time. We can predict when it's going to rise, even 300 years from now on a Wednesday afternoon, and would be probably pretty accurate. We have so many laws to say why things are the way they are. So chance is not the explanation. Necessity, law, is the explanation. The problem of necessity is if everything's governed by strict iron laws, how do we get so much variation? And we should all look alike. We should all talk alike. Hopefully, we'll be like Lizzie and Jane and not like Lydia and Kitty, but we'd all be like. But that's not our experience. With so much of difference, so much of variation everywhere. If everything's according to a law, how do we explain the unique fingerprint? And how do we explain consciousness? Because at least, I don't know about you, but one of the things I think about when I think about being conscious is, I can decide what to do. I can drink this, or I can not drink it. I can speak this word or not speak it. I can do so many things. It's all an illusion. If everything is done by a law, every word I'm going to say, every gesture, every... in all of this. So consciousness problem for the scientist. And he goes to great acts of imagination to try to figure out how chance and necessity can explain freedom and consciousness. Well, there's another hypothesis. It's the hypothesis of the extra cosmic deity, which is a good number of the religions in the world, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and many others. Here the theory is, it's not chance or necessity that's created the world, it's the divine. He's sitting up there. He's sitting up there creating the world, having his thoughts, using his omniscient knowledge and his omnipotent energy to create a world. It's an intelligence. That's why we get the order. And since he's in charge of everything, or she, I'm not sure who it is, he decides this should happen and that should happen, and he can change things anytime he wants, and that's why we're not all alike, because he'd be bored if we were all alike. So he creates all of us as a type, but he also creates a lot of variation. So, because he's conscious. If he's conscious, he can do that. He can write a story like Jane Austen. Not all the Bennett girls are alike. Every day is different. Every character is different. Even Lizzie and Darcy behave differently from time to time. So variation is there. It's quite simple. He's a cosmic author, like Jane Austen. And that explains why the order in things, and that also explains why the variation in things. Why? He's a great mathematician, so he can use all these mathematical formulas to build the world, but he's also an artist, so he can introduce the inspiration, he can put a drop of romance there, he can make things interesting and lively. But then the only problem is, the more we look at the world, if there's really a God up there who's creating all of this, could he have done better? I mean, why certain things seem to be so arbitrary? Why good people suffer? Why evil people thrive? Why so many things go wrong and get so confusing, and there's so much failure and suffering and ignorance, other people's ignorance, of course. Why some people are false? And most of all, where did this evil come from? You mean to say that this omniscient creator has created a world with characters of evil just for the enjoyment of it or something? Or just so he can punish us for the evil in it? It just doesn't make sense. And if you say these are the thoughts of God, God have had better thoughts. So it doesn't ring true. And the truth of the matter is, all of the religions that postulate an extra cosmic deity, none of them are able to answer satisfactorily the problem of ignorance, suffering, and evil, unless they do one thing. Well, there's not just a God, there's a devil. Oh, well, if there's God and a devil, then God is not the omniscient, omnipotent, supreme that we thought we were starting with. There's actually two gods. There's a positive and a negative. So then you get another religion, and you wonder who created both of them. Finally, we come to Sri Aurobindo's view, drawn very largely from Vedanta, but going beyond and filling in all the missing links that maybe were known in the time of Veda or the Upanishad, but have never been explicitly expressed. Maybe not, I think, but what does he say? Yes, a conscious, infinite, omniscient creator created the universe, but he didn't create something other than himself. He became the universe. He involved himself in the universe, or herself in the universe. He became the universe in order to manifest the infinite potentials that are there in potential in the infinite consciousness of Brahman. Well, if you had the problem that he has, or the divine has, of having infinite potential, just imagine if you were an author like Jane Austen, and you've got a million stories in your head, and you've got about a million characters that you would like to write about. How would you do it? You can't do it all at once. If Jane Austen told the story of Pride and Prejudice all at once, it would be Bennett's five daughters at Meryton, Bingley, Darcy, Collins, the Wickham come, they're married, and the story is over. All in one sentence. Or maybe you would reduce it and said, five daughters, three married. Okay. So if you want to, if an infinite, if you've got an infinite amount, you need a process by which you can express. And you probably need a lot of characters and an infinite number of events and an infinite amount of time in which to do it. So the divine has chosen a mechanism of becoming a universe in which it starts very simply. What does it start with? That energy that the scientist talks about that somehow builds itself up into elements, into molecules, into cells, into forms, into life forms. And then into conscious being in a process that's progressively evolving. And what is it evolving? It is evolving spirit in matter, in the universe, so that the infinite consciousness can appear in each form. And that's why the individual, all of us, hopefully, if not now, we will be. Each of us is a center for the divine to manifest its infinite potential uniquely. Not all the same. Because it has an infinite number of powers and potentials that it wants to express, and it needs an infinite number of us in order to uniquely express them in knowledge. Now we're in the ignorance on the process of waking up. So he says, there's a secret involved consciousness, cosmic, that acts infinitely behind the material energy that we see all around us. Everything is material energy. Everything that's happening is a frontal appearance. But what's trying to come out through all of that is an infinite consciousness is evolving to manifest itself. And he says every finite contains the concealed infinite. And nobody knows this better than the physicist, but he doesn't know that he knows it. Because he's discovered that even if you go down to the tiniest subatomic particle, it acts individually. You can't predict what it's going to do. Behaves in one way, if you don't look at it, it behaves in another way. And they've studied it, and they're totally baffled. And they've done thousands of experiments and spent billions of dollars to try to find out And they've even found out, you don't look at it, but you decide you're going to look at it a minute later. It starts behaving 1 minute earlier as if it knows you're going to look at it a minute later. And all of this has been scientifically, and all the rules in all your experiments are not going to explain anything. And we have to have it and realize that the answer in $1 billion machinery. We're not going to get to the answer no matter how many times we split. Every finite, which means every moment, which means every object. Have you ever had an object hide from you and come back? Some of you have. I've heard the story. Keys that disappeared for a long time. Ranjani had a cell phone that disappeared and went all the way to Madurai and came back and finally presented itself. Of course, she had a little help. Every moment is unique and original. The very step, next step, because the possibilities are there. One of Shakespeare's most famous plays, Othello. Othello's wife, Desdemona, the greatest event in the whole story is she dropped her handkerchief. It's a tragedy, so an evil man picks up the handkerchief and uses it to convince her husband that she's unfaithful to him. The handkerchief leads to tragedy. There's a famous, I think it was Schwerbindow who said, there's a famous German poet who wanted to express the tragedy in life. He writes a poem about a whole village being burned. He said the horror that that poet achieves by burning a village, Shakespeare achieved by dropping a handkerchief. Because the potential is there in the smallest thing. I saw it a couple of days ago. There's somebody who we're working with who's on the board of the World Academy who has given trouble in the past and a lot of trouble in the past, and now for the last few months completely disappeared. It was very silent. And Bodhapa and I noticed, you see, that man is not there at all anymore. Really great. I have a responsibility that I have to communicate to that. From what's going on. It's my duty. Within 1 hour, I got a message that the man has written. For 2 months, I've not heard anything, maybe 3 months. The moment I decide to contact him, I get a message from him. So what's the determinant? There is a determinant at every minute that decides not only what we do, but what other people are going to do with respect to us. And it's a conscious determinant. And it's a determinant in us. And the whole purpose of this chapter, indeed the whole purpose of the whole book, is not that we understand quantum theory and Big Bang and the biological evolution or how the universe created, but how we are creating our own universe all the time. And every detail in it, as surely as Jane Austen has fashioned the characters in her story and the events, as surely as Elizabeth, when she walks through the Pemberley and says, just think, I could have been mistress of him. And 5 minutes later, Darcy's standing there on the front lawn. She's created her reality. As sure as that, that's the vision that he wants us to get. That's the knowledge he wants us to get. Because the creator, infinite creator we were talking about a few minutes ago, That infinite creator that was not just standing out there, but came inside and created and became a universe, guess what? It became us too. He's there, each of us. And it's his power, or it is that power, which is acting through each of us, unfortunately in something we call the ignorant, to create the circumstances for our life and the consequences of those circumstances. So that's for what purpose? So that the hidden consciousness in us can come to the surface, can wake up, can emerge in self-discovery. It's that creator, it's that Brahman, which in Mrs. Bennett, a woman with a natural, healthy aspiration for marrying the five daughters. It's the power of that aspiration brings the suitors, the Samaritan, brings them to her house. But it's also will, the consciousness in her, no longer the consciousness of the deepest aspiration, but the consciousness of her surface ego, which says, ah, now I can triumph over Lady Lucas. Now I can tell, I can gloat over the greatness of my beautiful daughter, who's after all only taken after her mother's beauty. It has the power to spoil everything and create the circumstances for her. It's that hidden consciousness which brings Wickham to Meriton to scandalize Darcy falsely, totally falsely. The only true thing that Wickham said was that he's the godson of old Mr. Darcy. Everything else was a fabrication. So why? Why does he come? So that Lizzie can believe that lie, and when Darcy poses to her at Hunsford, he can say, why on earth, she can say, why on earth were you arrogant, proud, rude, offensive? You don't have any charm, you never smile. Why on earth? So that what? So that he can awaken to the hidden Godhead in him, bring it to the surface and shed all of this and say, yes, yes, you're right. I've been very selfish and mean and self-important and foolish and all I want in the world. I will change. I will change because I'm not this only. I can be more. I can be better. And he gets the opportunity to do it. So we means not our ego, but something in us, the hidden consciousness in us, or the divine in us, or the divine wherever we wish to place it, because it's everywhere, is happening at every moment the event for one purpose, to help the hidden consciousness evolve. Then once we accept this approach, we find all the problems with the other hypotheses disappear. Everything becomes simple, if not simple, at least understandable, finally. No longer this confusion and conflict. Why should there be an inconscient? An inconscient, he says, is the indispensable condition to create the structure of a material world for a consciousness that wants to bury itself and evolve in small increments to reveal all the infinite potential that's in it. One of the important things about the inconscient is it's necessary for us to create a sense of separateness, because there's nothing that's separate from anything else. Nothing exists separate from anything else. Even in society, go to a desert island and we'll find out how little we exist outside of the human society. The inconscient gives us the illusion that we're separate. Why should we be separate if we're all one? Because the divine wants to Manifest individuality. It's got so many different things it wants to say. If we're all saying the same thing, it won't get us far. So each of us expresses a unique aspect. So first of all, we have to have at least the sense of, it's an illusory sense, it's only an appearance of being separate. Anyone who tries to write a story, you'll see the problem and how essential this is. When I wrote my first draft of my novel, some of my friends who were more Frankfurt said, all the characters, I get them confused because they all sound like you. I said, that's very understandable because I'm using all of them to speak my idea. I'm not able to distinguish between myself and the characters. They're just all spokesmen for me. And a great author will never reflect that. Author, each character is unique. Each character, you can never mistake a Colin for a Wickham, Lydia and Jane. You can never mistake who said what. Even if you don't know, if you read a quote from the book, oh, that was Jane. Oh, it's exactly like Mrs. Bennet. That's Carolyn for sure, and unmistakable Lady Catherine. Each is unique. So that sense of is necessary to manifest an infinity. So we understand the divine created as the base. And what is it doing? What is it manifesting? What's the sense of all this? Well, he's going to tell us in the second half of the chapter. The purpose of the whole thing is for the divine to manifest truth and powers of its own infinite consciousness and being. And these truths and powers, and he's going to talk a lot about those later, are the reason what we call the determinant in nature. Those that there are things that are determined, not rigidly and fixed, but if you want to say what is the divine is power, the divine is knowledge, the divine is goodness, the divine is beauty, love, joy. These are cosmic determinants. The real determinants of the cosmos come from Satchitananda. They're divine qualities that manifest. And he's going to explain the process by which they manifest. And he's going to also explain in later chapters, if beauty is a divine quality, how do we end up with ugliness? And if goodness is a divine quality, how do we end up with evil? And if knowledge or truth is a divine quality, how do we get with the... We have to be a little patient. He's going to explain the whole thing. But he says, according to this view, everything, the reason that there is apparently things that are determined is because the divine is determining through the truths it wants to manifest. And all the forms we create in the universe are vehicles, are forms for the expression of that truth. So he says this is a solution to the paradox. It's very natural that we should see freedom and variation because the Creator is an infinite consciousness. It can create infinite variation. Just like Jane Austen in her story, just like Elizabeth, just like she's managed to create characters that are uniquely different, and at least one character who stands out in English literature as a real individual. Darcy's always bewildered. He never knows what Elizabeth's going to say next. He never knows how she's going to respond. She's unpredictable to him because she has the freedom to speak her mind. She doesn't just conform and do what other people do. At the other side, we have the fixed law that comes from the determinants, the truths and powers. And he tells us in Savitri and in this book, even death is only an expression of a power of the infinite. He says death is a necessary process of life so that the soul will be freed from the ossified forms that prevent its evolution. And in Savitri, Savitri has her dialogue with death and eventually exposes death as only an appearance. Behind death is God. Death is only a temporary appearance until we become conscious enough that we don't need death in order to keep evolving. The real determinant behind it is immortality, is the immortality of the divine, which is our immortality. We don't have immortality. We're identified with a body. He says this will also explain all the details, why the world seems to have a what he calls a mathematical architecture, why the elements are built up, one electron, two electrons, three electrons, why the science has discovered their mathematical formulas for everything. Everything has a formula. Where's the mathematics come from? Because it's the logic of an infinite, it is a logic, but it's not the finite logic of our minds, it's the logic of an infinite intelligence. The radius of a circle. Why circles all have a radius that can be calculated by a formula? The hypotenuse of a triangle, of a right triangle. The area of the circle or the circumference or all the laws of geometry. Where does it come from? It comes because all the forms have come from an infinite intelligence. Bee goes looking for pollen in the flower, and in the process goes from flower to flower and pollinates the other flowers. How does the bee is looking for its own food, for its own purposes, is helping the flowers reproduce, and because of that we get honey. There's purpose everywhere. There's complex intention everywhere that's not apparent. Wickham did not come to Meryton to help Lizzie marry Darcy, or vice versa. But that's exactly what he did, as surely as the bee is pollinating the flower. Lydia didn't elope in order to give Darcy an opportunity to really prove how much he loves Lizzie and elevate the whole family. But that's, she seemed to be doing the very opposite. But that's actually what she achieved. None of the characters in the story had any intention of promoting the social evolution of England to prevent revolutionary violence that was taking place in France. But all of the actions of all classes come together. There was an unseen intention behind, an unseen hidden will that was driving it. All, he makes a very simple statement, all the unexplained processes of nature are now explained. So now we can go home because we know everything, right? What have we understood? What did he explain? Well, he's the summarized form. And he summarizes it this way. I put it as a diagram. He says, the scientist has seen energy, and energy creating things, but we don't know why the energy creates what it creates, or how it knows what it creates. But we have to work backwards. Because he tells us, we see energy creating physical substance. After all, everything we have is really just a form of energy. That's what the scientist knows, and we know that. How does it create different forms of energy with different qualities? A diamond is different from coal, different from mud. He says, how does that force know what, where do all those qualities come from? Well, that energy that the scientist studies that makes physical substance is an expression of conscious force. He taught us that already I think it's chapter 10, that all energy in the universe is a manifestation of conscious force. But he's also told us that the conscious force is an expression of the existence, the infinite pure existence, as the previous chapter. The infinite existence expresses itself through a conscious force. What is that infinite existence? We don't see it. We don't know. What does it look like? We don't know, because it's spiritual substance. It's got a substance, but not a substance we can weigh or measure or see or detect with our senses. It's spiritual substance. And the basis of that spiritual substance, because it's a substance, he said, the aspects of quantity, design, and number are inherent in that substance. Whenever you talk about a substance, the spiritual substance, we can't measure anything, but whenever you talk about a substance, you say, how much does it weigh? How tall is it? How many do you have? What's the shape? These are inherent qualities of substance. Spirit is also a substance. Only thing, we don't have the sensory capacity or the instruments that can count it, weigh it, measure it, or look and see, or see it. But the capacity for quantity, design, and number is there in substance. Conscious force comes from existence. Energy comes from conscious force. Material substance comes from the energy. So the capacity for any shape, for any number, for any mathematical arrangement is inherent in the force that creates. And what does it create? Creates different qualities and different properties. It's a bit confusing because you say, if the basis of everything is quantity, is mathematics, well, the world doesn't look very mathematical to us. I mean, everybody's starting a different pattern and a different shape and a different color. I don't see the formula here. Where did all these colors come from? Accordingly, the computer can detect or display 64 million colors, isn't it? 64 million? How are there 64 million colors? Where do those colors are quality? Where do they come from? The scientist tells us each color is a different wavelength of light. Wavelength is a quantity. Wavelength is a number. The only difference is it's a little longer or a little shorter, and it gives a different quality. So how do these qualities come? They come from a variation in quantity. All the human genetic differences, and we do notice and feel quite different from one another, according to the latest theory in genetics, is there are four types of molecules. Complex molecules, and these four types of molecules combine together in different arrangements and sequences, and they constitute the DNA that creates a million different types of proteins and creates all of looking and different from one another. Four. Of quality. All of you who cook know a little too much salt and you spoil the sambar. A little too little salt and the quantity determines the quality. Why? Because he says quantity is there in existence. Existence is manifesting consciousness force, which is expressing as energy, and we see it on the surface as qualities and properties, and each different. Can you speak so that others will hear, we need a microphone. Here's the one.
During my time, the plant stem will do the mathematical calculation and design the food for the process.
Mm.
So the plant stem is just doing mathematics. So the reason is
they found that. They found the quantitative being in the plant itself. So we can understand the infinite variety of flowers and qualities they are have their basis in an infinite existence expressing itself through conscious force, through energy, gives expression to a variety of qualities. And of course, we already know this because we've all read Pride and Prejudice. We know that a conscious individual at the age of 19 conceived of a story, created different forms, different characters, each with different qualities, interacting with each other to portray this magnificent story. We know it was a conscious creator who fixed the laws, who fixed the forms, who fixed all the circumstances that to make this possible. We know how important that quality is. Darcy just spoke a little too loudly when he called her tolerable, and she overheard him. Wickham just knew the right expression, the right degree of pleasantness to win everybody's heart. Collins, whatever he did, he overdid it. He said, as soon as I get home, I'm going to write a thank you letter to you to tell you how grateful I am for coming. By telling us in advance that he's going to thank us when he gets home, somehow all of the sincerity of the thanks kind of dwindled. Just by a little too much. He speaks a little too much. Lizzie Darcy, who called her tolerable, when he begins to note a glint of light in her eyes, he's admiring and says, I'm admiring a pair of fine eyes. The quality is there. We know those tiny littlest things can make an infinite difference. So then he says, well, how does the tree emerge out of the seed? If you know the process, it's simple. The seed is only physical. The seed is a physical substance, but it contains a subtle truth, which he calls the real idea. The real idea is the power or significant truth that the divine wants to manifest through this physical substance. It's not the chemistry of the seed that tells it how to become a tree. It's the real idea. Contained, it's not contained in the physical seed, it's in the subtle substance of the seed, it's in the subtle aspect of the seed that determines the form that's going to manifest, the qualities that are going to manifest. That's why 800 different flowers can all manifest different spiritual qualities, because their origin is a spiritual idea that gives a form that can give expression to that spiritual vibration as a spiritual quality expressed as a grace flower or a prosperity flower or as lust or anything else. He says that also explains how psychological characteristics can be inherited. I mean, how does Lizzie has the same that Mrs. Bennett has when she sees a red coat, she finds it very attractive. In fact, she notices at one point Lydia is saying some very rude things about Mary King, and Lizzie is shocked to say, these are exactly the thoughts I was thinking. I'm just like my sister. It's all, her physical appearance is inherited. How does the psychology inherit? He says the psychological character is there in the subtle substance of the gene, just like the real idea is there in the subtle substance of the seed. And therefore, character also can be inherited, which the scientist speculates about, but has no way to explain. He sees the phenomena. They've done studies of identical twins. There was, I remember one example, there were two girls, identical twins, twin girls who were separated at birth. And one of them was moved to the U.S. and the other was in Germany. And I think at the age of 40, the scientists found them out and brought them together. First, they tested them. They came out, and I don't remember exactly, but it things like this. They both married people with the same name. There were a number of things like that, 5, 10, 20 things in which they were almost identical, though they'd never known each other. They didn't even know that they existed. Even those things were programmed in their genes. He says this also explains, and we're going quickly over things which he's going to write about in much more detail later on in the book, but he says this also explains the influence that the body can have on our mind. The scientist is trying to convince himself that all our mental activity, all our psychological activity is only a result of our hormones and our electrical impulses and the chemistry of the body. And of course we know that our moods can be determined by our hormones. That's a common experience, especially for ladies. We know that when we're tired, we can become short-tempered and unreasonable and irritable and irrational and several other things too. We know there's a relationship, but we don't understand why. He says there's a secretly conscious energy in the form of the body. The body we think is just inert, like the stone or the plastic or the bottle. The body is secretly conscious. It's got a consciousness in it. And there are times in which that consciousness can take over and act, even ignoring what we say, what we do. When Bingley comes in the middle of the dance and tells Darcy, don't be stupid, Darcy, dance, I don't think he sat there and said, let me say something very intelligent. Some people said, she's tolerable. It just came out. It was a reaction because he was offended by Bingley calling him stupid. It's not like he thought that way. I think probably most of us have had that expression, that experience of saying things. I said, I don't know why I said that. I didn't think. You didn't think, but you spoke. How did you speak without thinking? Well, my body spoke for me. My vitals spoke for me. It's true, the body, the mind didn't think, the body did. Involuntary reaction before the mind can control itself. But this also explains the opposite, which is much more interesting, how the mind can control the body. If the consciousness, if there's a consciousness in the body, it also means our mental consciousness can work in the other direction. That's very interesting. He said, the fact that the body can control the mind, which is the theory of science, is a minor truth. It's true, but it's very minor. And all their studies of the chemistry and the hormones is only going to, they're explaining why if you give this drug, a man acts depressed or he acts excited, and therefore all depression and excitement and happiness and love and everything are only chemicals. That's a minor truth, greatly distorted. It's a major truth. And that is the mind can control the body and determine the body. And he said there's a still deeper truth that there's a hidden spiritual entity installed in the substance which can determine both the mind and the body. That's what made Darcy fall in love with Elizabeth. and come to Pemberley just when she was there. Well, we've discussed in, and I'm sure in many of the other meetings, we've discussed examples of the power of consciousness over substance. We've been mentioning a lot the example of Morris Goodman, who crashed the airplane, broke every bone in the body. He couldn't speak, he couldn't breathe, and the doctors gave him 5 days to live. He couldn't even speak. He could only blink his eye, and he blinked to his sister. He set up a code and said, within 1 year, I'm going to walk out of this hospital. And the doctor said, don't encourage him. Within 5 days, he's going to be dead. Don't get your hopes up. And within 1 year, he walked out of the hospital. They said it's medically, physically impossible that this man lives, let alone ever walk again. Something had that power over the body. I've mentioned in earlier talks about what the scientist calls the placebo effect. Every pharmaceutical company in the world knows about the placebo effect, and every doctor in the world knows about the placebo effect, and they have studied it very, very, very detailed, thousands of studies. If you give a person, if they're having a migraine, headache, or arthritis, you give them this drug, which is the best drug on the market, and they say, oh yes, 50% of them say this drug works pretty well for me. And if you give a piece of candy to an equal number of people saying, here's the latest drug for arthritis, 40% of them say this works very well. So what does it mean? It means 40% out of the 50% of the cure is just because they think, the mind thinks it's getting a cure, and only 10% is actually due to the drug. Now they have a suspicion even that 10% may not be due to the drug, because when you take the patients are very smart, they go home and read about the drug, and they say, if this drug has certain side effects, it'll cause acidity in the stomach. But when I took the drug, it didn't have any side effects. I must be taking the placebo. So it must work less. They guess as to whether the drug, they're having the real drug or not. They know the symptoms, and the patients are very much aware. So the problem that the doctors, and we should feel sorry for the medical industry now, they're having a difficulty now, a very serious difficulty. It's getting more difficult to produce new drugs. Not because the science is less powerful than before, but because the placebo is getting stronger and stronger. They measured it over the last 30, 40 years. Whatever you give the patient, he's getting better results now than he got in the past. Why? Because the patients are believing more and more in the power of medicine. Really not the power of medicine at all that's curing them, it's the power of their own belief. So they've been extending that now. They've started doing surgery, where they actually perform surgery, they cut the person open, but they don't do anything. And then they stitch him back. They wait for the next day and sees this big bandage and he feels the pain. Oh, they opened me. Oh, they've done this. And they find out when they don't do anything, they call it sham surgery. He's also getting the result. Almost as much as the one who they did the surgery on, because he thinks he's had the surgery. This is mind over matter. Instead of having faith in the surgery, in the medicine, in the doctor, if we have that faith in our own mind, we can do it without any of that. In fact, if we believe that mother can cure, if we believe that mother has the power to cure, that accepting, it's a truth. It's not a belief. It's a universal truth. It's a cosmic determinant. that the spirit which has created the whole universe can probably handle our stomach ache or our headache or our arthritis. It's a common sense. But if we believe it in that measure, we rise from the physical mind to the power of that truth. And that power acts. The power is in our capacity to accept it. The power is there, but it's the acceptance by our mind that determines that power act, or we have that power, meaning we are the determinant, not the mind, the deepest faith in us. And that's the whole secret of lifetime. That's the whole message he's trying to communicate to us. That's what he's trying to tell us. We are determinants, not Mrs. Bennett's glorious ego that wants to triumph over everybody, but her deepest aspiration. Not Darcy's sense of wealth and self-importance and arrogance and pride that won't pardon anybody, but the deepest aspiration for love. That is the determinant, and that is infinitely powerful. And the whole purpose of this creation is for that secret consciousness that's buried in each of us to come to the surface. And that's what Sri Aurobindo means to an individual. And that is our destiny. That is the destiny of every soul. That is the destiny of the divine in the universe. That's spiritual evolution. It is the divine revealing itself in each of us as the Ishwara. Mrs. Bennett's aspiration is true. She gets 4 suitors and 3 husbands. She missed one by her spoiling thing. Her actions are egoistic and disastrous. In spite of that, she gets 3 daughters married in a year. Mr. Bennett's sense of duty is true. His sense of honor is true. It brings untold wealth to the family. Darcy's sense of sincerity and goodness and consciousness, responsibility is true. It's a pure act of spiritual self-giving, without any bargain, without any expectation. It gives him what his heart desires. There's a practical knowledge in this chapter, which we'll go further next week. There is a truth trying to manifest in us, and there is a grace that can enable that truth to act at every moment, provided we withdraw our active insistence on the surface ignorance and assertion and preference, like the characters have in the story, provided we really can go inside and consecrate and let the inner truth express, thy will be done. Sri Aurobindo has a statement, faith and grace are not altogether mixed. Faith and grace are not altogether mixed. What are faith and grace? Grace, we know, is that divine up there, which has become everything, calling down to awaken us from the ignorance. Then what is our faith? Huh? Faith, real faith is that same divine buried deep within us, calling for itself to come down. This is a two-way dialogue between the divine. Between the divine in the superconscious above and the divine in the subconscious below. And they're calling to each other. And in between come all of our opinions, preferences, attitudes, assertions. Oh, I know better than all of this. We get in the way of this. What Mother means by sincerity is our rejecting ego so that inner divine can sincerely call, and are accepting what comes down as grace, knowing that whatever comes is really for our progress, not to be avoided. When Darcy, when Dingley introduces, tries to introduce him to Jane, instead of calling tolerable, he must know it's grace pointing him towards a divine future. Nature is revealing to us there's a divine above. Life revealing to us there's a divine inside. And it's the play between these two that is our evolution. The key for us is to be able to distinguish between aspiration and ambition. Aspiration to be great, ambition to be great, self-important, better than other people, knowing more, having more, doing more, gaining the prestige so that everybody will look up to us. Aspiration is the sincerity of wanting to release the inner truth, not only in ourselves, but in everyone else we meet and at every moment, so that goodness and self-giving and harmony can manifest everywhere. This is the truth of the book. This is the truth of this chapter. We have not gotten to the halfway point in the chapter, but I think he gives us a tremendous amount. It's to be discovered in every act, in every moment. There's a little time left if anyone would like to ask a question here or in any of the other centers. Anybody?
Gary?
Ashok, yes. Hi.
In the beginning of your speech, I saw a slide on the screen that said that it's a quotation from the mother saying that each one's spiritual experience is unique to himself and that it is not to be imposed on others. Now I can understand religious beliefs are not to be imposed on others. I have myself heard you protesting to Appa that you can't go and impose your religious beliefs on somebody else when you meet people for official purposes. I can understand religious beliefs being imposed on others, somehow it goes wrong. But now she says that even spiritual experiences are not to be imposed on others, and be imposed, it can go wrong. Let us say somebody spends long hours doing meditation and that works fine for that person. If that person starts imposing on others, you also spend long hours sitting in meditation like me, it may not work well. Because most people are somewhat dynamic, they can't sit for long hours. But generally we recommend consecration to everybody who comes asking for solution for problems. Is it possible that one person's experience with consecration need not become universally true for others? that if consecration is uniformly imposed on whoever comes seeking solution to problems, it can go wrong, something like that?
I think it's a very good question. So I think the first thing is to understand why they say that. The tradition doesn't say that. Maybe it's easier to understand why the tradition doesn't say that. Because tradition is, we should get to moksha. We have a common destiny. We're all going to the same place. Josh, how do you go? Well, you go by the East Coast Road, or you go the main highway via Kindivenam and Singletary. Either way. But where do you want to go is the question. The divine wants to go everywhere. The divine didn't, according to Sri Aurobindo, the divine did not become millions of souls so that we should all go from Pandi to Madras, or from earth to moksha. The divine became millions of souls so that it could manifest millions of different qualities and capacities and potentialities of an infinite being, of an infinite divine being. So, if we all go in the same direction by the same route, we're not going to manifest infinity. We each have a unique, in the tradition, we each have a common, identical goal. Get out of here as quickly as possible, stop the ignorance, shed even the individual soul, and merge back into Chidananda. But that's not the purpose, he tells us. The purpose is Satchitananda wants to manifest here infinitely, and must infinitely manifest uniquely in each person. And therefore, the experiences that we each need are unique. So that doesn't mean there are no methods that we can learn from. Consecration is a method we can all apply. But we'll each apply it differently, and it will have a different result according to our consciousness, according to our motives, according to our not only our past experience, but also what's trying to manifest itself. If we each call Mother, she's going to give it not the same inspiration to each of us, but a different inspiration. Calling Mother works. Not that we each must see Mother in the same form, or we each have the same experience. Mother herself says, she never had the same spiritual experience twice. I don't think it's there in the tradition. In all the traditions, the guru tries to teach the same spiritual experience to each of his disciples. He gives a mantra so that all the disciples should become mini clones of him. Whereas for Mother, every disciple, every devotee should become a unique expression because the Ishwara should manifest in each of us. Methods are there. Many methods are there. But what result we get, how we use those methods, that's why Sri Aurobindo gives the method. The ultimate method is called Mother and consecration, faith, aspiration, rejection, sincerity, surrender. These are powerful methods. But what does it mean to be sincere? There's a sincerity in the physical, a sincerity in the vital, a sincerity in the mental, a sincerity inside. Each of us must find, it's not a particular yogic pose, hatha yoga pose, it's not a particular method of pranayama. We can use all of those things if it helps us. But no packaged solution is going to work for everybody to get to manifestness. Our goal is spiritual uniqueness, not spiritual clone. Does it help?
Okay, I do get your viewpoint. Then in another place she says that knowledge is true only so long as it is fresh. This makes me come to the conclusion that maybe when it's no longer fresh, it's no longer true or something. Why does she say that? I can understand that food is good to eat only when it is fresh, and when it is stale and old, it's no longer good to eat. How can that be applied to knowledge?
I think if we look practically, we know that this is true for us. I don't know the exact context in which Mother said it, but I understand there's a great truth in it. When we have an experience, when we read something in Love Divine or in Abba's book, or we learn something, it's very fresh for us. It gives us a fresh insight, gives us a fresh understanding. And if we start repeating it to other people or even repeating to ourselves, after a while, we find the words are coming out, but it's no longer having the inspiration. Because what we call knowledge, not the spiritual truth of knowledge in Satchidananda or Supermind, what we call knowledge is a particular formation or expression of a truth, like the words. And those words, after a time, they tend to lose their inspiration. We remember the words, we forget the inspiration that brought the words, that brought the experience, that brought the words. It's a very common thing for us. If you describe the most wonderful experience in your life, and you pretty soon you'll find out while you're telling the story, you're thinking of something else. And there's no life left in it, because it becomes to our external personality. I think what Mother meant was, or at least I know it's true in this sense, that the form in which we express something has to change over time. The Sri Aurobindo said, there's no sense. The Veda, the Upanishad, the Gita are magnificent treasures of the past with great truths in them, but those truths were spoken at a different time, expressed in a language for a people at a different stage of development, in a different context, which was an inspiration for them. There are very few people, if anybody, who really even knows the truth of the Vedas anymore, let alone can be inspired by it. And that's true for the others as well. They become, that's why he starts synthesis by saying that all forms need to be perpetually destroyed and renewed, even when the essence and truth of them is eternal. The forms tend to become ossified over time. So it needs to be expressed in fresh terms. I think it's the first chapter of Synthesis of Yoga, in which there have been hundreds of paths of yoga. Even if they were all great, we need something that will express where humanity is today, where we are today. I think there's one other sense in which Mother may have meant that. For the spirit, everything is fresh. For the mind, everything becomes a fixed form and a habit. She says, what happens to us if you have a wonderful experience? What you want to do is, if you sat down and had a wonderful experience, the next day we want to sit down and have the same experience again. And we end up remembering the past experience, which is different than feeling it, and thinking about having it, and being sorry that we don't have it. And Mother says, you are a spirit. You are capable of infinite freshness and creativity. Don't look back. Look to the future. Create. You can create infinitely. Don't cling to the past, even if it's 24 hours old. Don't cling to the insight that you had yesterday as if it's the ultimate. You know the message of Chapter 1, which Appa is constantly reminding us of. The clear message of Chapter 1 is, don't stop in the middle. And why does he say that? He said, because the rishis and the yogis stopped in the middle. They got a pathway there, they discovered the spirit, and they thought that was the end of the journey. They saw that mind had evolved from life in matter, and they said the next stop is to moksha. They didn't realize that the mind is continuing to evolve. So we shouldn't be limited by our past realization, no matter how much great it is. I give you another final practical experience. If you read Life Divine, one chapter, one paragraph, And the moment you say, oh, I understand it fully, let me explain it to you, at that point we close. A sincere experience is, no matter how many times you I'm finding that even in private training. That the more you, if you say, oh, I know the story backwards and forth, please don't tell me that story again. But I find once or twice or three times a week, I'm just amazed at it was this insight I mentioned earlier today, just occurred to me day before yesterday on one of the calls. See, supposing Bingley had said no to Darcy, I don't want to marry Jane, what would have been Darcy's position? You suddenly get a whole different view of the situation. No, Darcy, you're absolutely right. You gave me good advice. You're a very intelligent man. I respect you so much. I will only follow your advice. I know out of nice things you're trying to adjust with me. Darcy has to really beg him. Darcy will be in a panic. His whole house now depends on Bingley of reversing his attitude and Bingley coming along and reversing his decision about Jane. And the most amazing thing is this very mild, meek, submissive man managed to get Darcy, who's a very opinionated, determined, strong man, to which he's totally submitted himself, he managed to get Darcy to reverse himself. Maybe without even trying. Without even thinking. How did that reversal take place? For Bingley, it's the ultimate accomplishment. He got the mountain to come to him and say, please marry Jane. So like that, there's nothing, our whole life is like that. Knowledge concealed, and you're going to tell me this. Papa has told me some of the stories of his life so many times. Still don't get it. You're still not listening to me. You think you know what I'm going to say. You still miss the point. That's what we are with knowledge. So, whatever the form of the knowledge, the value of the knowledge is in the inspiration that it carries. In the measure it inspires us, okay. The moment it becomes flat and we say, I think I know this already, it means we need to rediscover the truth of it. Very good question. Anything
Mary?
Else? Yes.
Somewhere mother's statement is not consistent to my understanding. You see, she says knowledge is true only so long as it is fresh. Meaning the moment it gets old, it's no longer true or something. But then you take buildings like Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal is 400 years old. It was built as a sign of one man's expression of love for his wife. Even after 400 years being old, people, when they see the building, they are still moved by its beauty. How can its beauty strike you fresh after 400 years of having been there? Somehow this is inconsistent.
There are a lot of good answers or a lot of ways to answer that. It's fresh for each of us when we go to the Taj Mahal the first time. Talk to the tour guide who goes to the Taj Mahal every day and explains and tells the same story every day for some money, and ask him how fresh and inspired he is by the Taj Mahal. That's one answer, which is very consistent with what Mother said. It's fresh for us when we go the first time, because it's fresh knowledge for us. Then I would say there's another way in which this is true for Mother, and that is the idea of eternal love 400 years ago was to build a mausoleum for a wife after her death. It's essentially a cemetery, it's a grave, it's a beautiful grave. But it's to immortalize the death of the woman Are we capable of a greater monument to love in the future than that? It's a beautiful building, I agree. But does it express the highest inspiration? At that time, maybe that was the highest form in which love could be immortalized. Because that there was a time when people died at any moment due to any disease. You could never be sure of anything. Life was so fickle. Death really seemed to be the divine that was determining everything. So love gets immortalized in the dead form. Is it possible today to immortalize love in a higher way than that? Has it been done? I don't know. When we read Pride and Prejudice, I think one of the things we constantly see is how rare real love is even in literature. I mean, even this love, this story, which is more the love of Darcy for Elizabeth than vice versa. It's not what we could call the highest imaginable story of love. And if you look at love in Shakespeare, almost without exception, the great love stories like Romeo and Juliet and Desdemona are tragedies. The only way they can express great love is send my regards to my fair lord who just killed me. That's not exactly the highest idea can I love to. Superminder's descendant. What about the people who live for the country to make it great? What about the people who uplift the country and elevate the people? It's not just dying for something that any longer need to be the highest achievement. The whole of Christianity is based on God coming down and dying for humanity. I don't think it's the highest inspiration that we can have about the divine. So I think that's another sense. Knowledge changes. What we talk about knowledge, the world is evolving spiritually. It's never the same. Therefore, all forms of knowledge, however valid they are, may not be the ultimate expression for the world that's emerging and the truths that are trying to emerge in the future. Okay, that's all.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Ashok. Very good question.
First, I'm thanking Mr. Gary to give this such a jubilant speech today. I have some thoughts on it. Why he gave this speech today, the cosmic determinant. When we started the web meeting calls, it was only on fourth Sunday the live divine calls were decided. But from last February, because of his tours and travels, he has changed his program. And he gave the speeches on third Sundays, on first Sundays, the dates were changed. On May, he gave the speech on supermind and overmind. But that speech was not clear in our center. And last month, I requested him to give the speech and second time. He agreed and he gave the speech last month. If in the program, according to the program, he is giving the speech. The last month, he has to give the speech on cosmic determinant. But why he gave this speech on cosmic determinant today? because I have an answer, because tomorrow is his birthday. It was already determined by mother that this for this day. And on behalf of all the senders and all the devotees, we are wishing a happy and prosperous and jubilant advance birthday wishes.
Thank you, Vijaya, and everybody, for your good wishes there. Thanks.